for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Peter Goodman is a national economics writer for the New York Times. Previously, he covered the internet boom and bust as the Washington Post telecommunications reporter. Now in a new book, he chronicles the roots and consequences of the current recession and suggests ways to renew the American economy. His new book is titled Past Due. And Peter Goodman joins me in the studio. Of course, we invite your participation as well. I look forward to hearing from you. You can call us on 800-433-8850. You can send email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, Peter. It's good to have you here.
Good morning, Diane. Thanks very much for having me.
You've been at the Times for the last 2 years, and as I said, you previously looked at what happened with the tech boom and bust. How is this recession different?
This recession's different because it's landing on top of a long period in which most Americans really didn't benefit at all. So for a great number of Americans, it was as if they were already experiencing a recession. We had very lean job growth through the last so-called expansion. We had income stagnating and declining for the majority of Americans. And so when the financial crisis hit, when we finally lost our belief in all of these narratives that had propelled growth from the internet bubble, where a lot of money moved on this idea that the internet was changing everything, and then during the real estate bubble, people could pull money out of their houses and spend money even though they didn't have income to support. And when we finally ran out of that belief and the financial system shut down and all of a sudden businesses and ordinary people couldn't get their hands on money, we had a catastrophe. And that landed, again, on top of a period where incomes just hadn't been growing for...
In the book, you talk about some of the people who were hit particularly hard. You talk about people like Dorothy Thomas and what happened to her when the bill finally came due.
Yeah, I met Dorothy Thomas in a job center in Oakland, California in February 2008. And at that point, she was living in a really awful part of town on a street that she and her roommate called Crack Avenue, in a house that had the water shut off for lack of payment. The electricity was shut off. There were these huge purple mold spores on one wall. It turned out the landlord hadn't been paying the rent, and soon they were foreclosed, and she landed in a homeless shelter. But this is a woman who'd been earning $22 an hour for much of her adult life. She had grown up in rural poverty in Oklahoma. She's African-American, and she was sent to one of the first forcibly integrated school districts in her community. And she had never gotten through college, but she had this real drive, you know, I'm going to get my daughters out of college. And she had these two girls, and she intentionally lived in better neighborhoods. She moved out to California and she intentionally lived in better neighborhoods
than
she could
really
afford.
But how could she afford it?
Well, easy money. She strategically didn't pay some bills. She tapped credit cards. I mean, she kept it together for, you know, nearly 20 years. She worked as a cocktail waitress on the side to come up with money to buy her daughters cheerleading outfits so they'd feel at home in school, to send them to science camps, to get them tutoring. I mean, she patched things together, but eventually ran into trouble. And one day in 2006, she's driving through San Jose, California, where she was then living, and a cop pulls her over, notices that her license plate has expired. She had forgotten to pay a $10 registration sticker. It seemed like a marginal expense. I mean, it wasn't the smartest thing she'd ever done in her life to not pay it, but you know, she had a lot of balls in the air. And this cop said, "Well, I'm towing your car away." Mm. Without a car, she couldn't get to her job, so she lost her job. Without a job, she couldn't pay her rent, so she lost her house. And she moved in with a roommate up in Oakland on the street she called Crack Avenue. And when that house got foreclosed on, she ended up in a homeless shelter.
And she had to pretend she was a drug addict in order to get into that shelter.
That's right. When I saw her in November of 2008, at that point, she had been without work for more than a year. She'd been looking relentlessly, and the only way for her to stay in this shelter, it was a shelter for people with addiction problems and for victims of domestic violence, was to pretend that she was a drug addict.
But, Peter, at the same time, one has to ask, what about her daughters? Where were they at this point?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, one daughter had just started college and was in no real position to help. The other daughter was helping. Her daughter, Sean, had gotten a master's in education and was teaching. But, you know, she had a moderate salary. She was a public school teacher. And Dorothy's a very proud woman. I mean, this is a woman who had gotten through a lot. She described, you know, "I'm the rock of my family. I'm used to people being able to depend on me." It was very humiliating for her to have to ask for help.
How did you find her?
I found her because I was sitting in this job center in Oakland. I wanted to do a story looking at the fact, I mean, this was sort of early in the recession, that the fact that if you didn't have a job, it was enormously difficult to find one. And in fact, I mean, it's a very strange recession in that layoffs, though there have been many of them and they are wrenching, have not been the dominant story. The real story is that for years, companies have not hired. There was all this talk of the new economy, you know, back when the internet bubble was happening, which was largely a mythology. But one thing, in one respect, we really do have a new economy. Companies just don't hire aggressively during good times, because in the same way we have the sort of just-in-time management of inventory, we have that with workers too. So I was sitting in Oakland trying to sort of get a feel for who's here and how are they doing and what's it like to try to find a job. And here was Dorothy sitting in a class for people with bad credit. And I thought, well, that seems sort of peripheral. Mm. Why is she trying to build up her credit? Turned out she had almost been offered a job, and then they checked her credit. And they said, well, this is a test of your character. That was her understanding. And she didn't get the job. So here you have people trying to dig their way out of bad credit problems. And their bad credit actually becomes an impediment to getting a job.
Peter Goodman, his new book is titled Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. At the other end of the economic scale, you talk about Fran Barbaro. She's a white 50-year-old mother. She has an MBA and a resume full of six-figure salary computer industry jobs. So how does she end up facing foreclosure?
Well, Fran ends up being a victim of bad choices that she makes, but I would argue this kind of gold rush fever that swept the country between the technology bubble and the real estate bubble, many of us, most of us perhaps, got this feeling that, you know, we didn't have to plan financially. I mean, you know, we're the country of Ben Franklin, who, you know, admonished us not to get into debt and to always square our spending against our income. Well, Ben Franklin never met, you know, an option arm mortgage that invited us to pay less than even the interest due each month. You know, never lived during a time when home equity lines of credit offers landed in your mailbox, you know, seemingly by the dozen every week. So Fran was this woman who, you know, she, like many Americans, she had an illness which set her back financially, but she had $1 million stock portfolio. She was a stock picker. She didn't feel like she was doing anything particularly unusual like everybody else. She sort of paid attention to the market back when talking about NASDAQ stock tips in the 90s was almost, you know, acceptable cocktail party chatter. She read the Financial Times, she read the Wall Street Journal, and she bet on companies that seemed very solid, Cisco Systems, Microsoft, IBM, and her stock portfolio swelled to $1 million. And she got accustomed, as she put it to me, she said, the money was always there. You know, I had sons who had learning disabilities. They required these special programs that ran $25,000 a year after school, special camps. She put art on her walls. She went on vacation. She didn't feel that she was living particularly large. Now, had she actually gone through the exercise of saying, here's what I make, it's about $150,000 a year, here's what I'm spending, this can't continue, it would have stopped, except for the fact that, you know, the stock portfolio was there. After the stock portfolio got whacked by the end of the tech bubble, all of a sudden her house is worth nearly $1 million, and at will, she can, you know, tap it, borrow against it, take out a credit card that pulls money from her house. I mean, we got to a point where we felt like credit was savings.
But, you know, it's interesting that you use the word victims. There may be a lot of people out there who feel that individuals like Fran were not only perhaps victims of a too easy money system, but were also victims of their own lack of real thoughtfulness about what they were doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. There are plenty of people listening right now thinking, well, I didn't do that. You know, I was careful, and now I have to bail out people who weren't careful. They're entitled to that sentiment. I mean, we all took a departure from our what had been the norms of American society, or one could argue just simply common sense. But the point that I'm trying to make in this book is that didn't happen by accident. It happened in part because wages were stagnating for people in the middle, and for people at the top, we were exposed to this gold rush mentality.
Peter Goodman, New York Times reporter. His new book is titled Past Due. Stay with us. I look forward to hearing from you. And if you've just joined us, New York Times economics reporter Peter Goodman is here. We're talking about what happened to people who got caught up in the economic downturn, who not only lost their wealth, they lost their homes, they lost their jobs, perhaps in part because the money out there was too easy, perhaps because their mentality got caught up in this whole idea of, don't worry, it's going to be fine. What else happened, Peter?
Well, the point I really try to make in the book is that while it's true that, you know, decadence, departure from common sense certainly played a real role in how we got into this mess, if you were living in this society, you got caught up in it either unwittingly or almost against your will. I mean, if you lived in a booming housing market, if you lived in L.A. or San Diego or Seattle or Miami, and you wanted to live in a decent school district and you wanted to buy a house, which was, you know, something that society had been telling you you should aspire pretty much your whole life.
The American dream.
That's the American dream. If you were buying in 2005, you either had to pay an incredibly inflated price and probably use some funny money mortgage, unless you were lucky to have real means, to live in a place where you could send a kid to a decent school, or you effectively had to go against another societal message and say, well, I'm not going to play that game. I'm not going to keep up with the Joneses and send my kid to a good school. If you needed health care and the cost of health care was going up and somebody was sick or a kid required attention in school or, you know, you had a need, you were operating in a society where not only were many people around you at work, in social settings, you know, telling you about their spec houses, they were flipping houses or, I mean, a home equity line of credit, which we once called a second mortgage in this country,
right,
began to seem like a very conventional thing. Or back to Fran Barbaro in Boston. She's not day trading. She's not buying stocks you've never heard of and, you know, selling them for, you know, 1,000% profit in a matter of minutes, as some people were. She's not one of these, you know, talking heads on television, you know, telling you about internet stocks and momentum investing. She's reading the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times and seeing that, Cisco Systems, they're selling an awful lot of product. This is the building blocks of the internet. And how is she supposed to know that Cisco Systems has a market by dint of the fact that we're borrowing these extravagant sums of money, that there are derivatives that are trading that make it seem like all this money is insured against? And on Wall Street, money's moving like it's never moved before. And that's creating a market for, you know, everything. So at any rate, it was a gold rush that seemed to make sense. The norm shifted. So things we never would have done before became, you know, common. And that got us into trouble.
And how far back does this trouble go? When does it begin? There are an awful lot of people who talk about the Bush administration, the lack of regulation, but you in the book go back to the Clinton administration.
Yeah, it definitely goes further back. I mean, it was in the Clinton administration where we got a shock that should have set us straight. In 1998, a hedge fund called Long Term Capital Management nearly collapsed. There were fears it was going to take down the global financial system. A bunch of bankers got in a room and came up with, I think, $3.5 billion to pay off the debts. And, you know, at the time, very smart people like George Soros said, boy, we better have some regulations on these things called derivatives that were part of the mess.
Nobody paid attention.
Well, not only that, the opposite message was taken. So Alan Greenspan drew the conclusion, well, you see, we can really count on the good people of Wall Street to fix the mess. And so the leverage in the system, the amount of borrowed money just simply grew. And Bob Rubin, who is President Clinton's Treasury Secretary, and his deputy, Larry Summers, who's now President Obama's chief economic advisor, they helped kill attempts to regulate derivatives. And these derivatives, which seemed like insurance policies, you know, it seemed like the risks were spread, gave the system confidence that, you know, if anything went wrong, somebody was on the hook for the trouble. And so the borrowed money just swelled and it seeped down into every crevice of the economy.
So what about the reactions of the Bush administration to the financial crisis? How did that help or hurt what then happened to the people who got caught?
Well, the Bush administration was very late in recognizing the fact that we had a crisis. I mean, both the Clinton and the Bush administrations pushed expanded home ownership. Congress certainly has responsibility. Policies were put in place that encouraged, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to continue to guarantee more and more mortgages. And this translated into incentives for your corner mortgage broker to write loans to anybody who was willing to apply for a housing loan because they could sell them, because the government was willing to buy lots of mortgages that previously wouldn't have been purchased in the name of expanding home ownership. I mean, there's a lot of blame to go around. But certainly one thing we have to mention here is that Alan Greenspan, while he was running the Fed, dropped interest rates very, very low after the tech bubble and kept them there for a very long time. And meanwhile, we had these global imbalances where, you know, we were buying lots of stuff from China, sending our dollars to China. China was taking our dollars and buying up our debt through U.S. Treasuries, and that was helping keep interest rates very low in this country. And we weren't particularly disciplined about it. And so this money just went swelling into real estate, and real estate prices went skyrocketing. And that gave people the opportunity to then borrow more and more from their homes. And you know, at every time somebody would say, you know, this could end badly, Alan Greenspan in particular would say, oh, no, there can't possibly be a housing bubble.
You're putting an awful lot of responsibility on his shoulders.
Well, if you had to pick one person, and you can't, in truth, but if you had to pick one person who probably has most responsibility, it is Alan Greenspan. I mean, Alan Greenspan was the ultimate regulator of the financial system. Alan Greenspan was our respected wise man. I mean, when Alan Greenspan went to Congress and testified in front of various committees, you know, tell us what's going on, he was the maestro. You know, his voice had an incredible authority.
But what about the moment when he began talking about irrational exuberance on Wall Street and in the financial markets?
Alan Greenspan talked about irrational exuberance in 1996, and it's a shame that he didn't heed his own counsel. He could have helped us avoid the irrational exuberance that continued to build by lowering interest rates, by looking at the quality of the loans that were later made in real estate, by taking a look at the proliferation of dot-coms, and all of the businesses that were dependent upon the demand created for American goods and services by the internet bubble. And instead, you know, he issued this phrase and hoped that he could sort of jawbone us into adopting some common sense. But with the other hand, he kept the easy money flowing by keeping interest rates, you know, very, very low for a long time.
Here's an email from Phil. He says, please discuss the concept of the quant fund. Quant. What is the quant fund?
Well, I mean, I think what Phil's talking about is this whole generation of people on Wall Street, these mathematical geniuses who've come up with these financial models based on very sophisticated algorithms and ways of measuring risk. That unfortunately take on their own momentum. There are so many programs that have been unleashed by, you know, some very smart and for a while very well compensated people that use math to take advantage of movements in the market. But of course, once one person does that, that affects the market. And ultimately, I mean, it's a little bit like trying to justify the value of your house based on every house around you.
He goes on to say, based on my own very rudimentary understanding of the quant fund, the concept seems like pure mathematical fantasy. How is it possible to sustain a profitable business model when investors are not buying into consumer desire, intelligent product design, or anything else that makes real world sense? Isn't there a moral issue here? Is it appropriate to run a business based on the manipulation of algorithms and numbers that only a handful of mathematics PhDs really understand?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, I'll say this, and I say this in the book. We've had a disconnect in recent years between our inherent skills, which are still many in this country. I mean, we have great innovation, we have great minds, and the production of real products, real services that are of genuine value. I mean, we've essentially come up with ways to make money move around, whether it's, you know, this idea that the internet is going to change every business model and generate demand that we can't even measure, and because we can't measure it, therefore the sky's the limit in terms of the price of everything, to the real estate bubble where we convinced ourselves that, well, you know, forget the dot-coms. That was a con, but a house? Come on, it's a house. I mean, you can't live in a share of, you know, worthless dot-com stock, but you can really live in a house. And on that truth, we built this fantasy that, you know, there was no end to demand for housing, and therefore housing prices could never fall. Well, we lost our way. You know, we ended up in, I say in the book, we ended up in Neverland, in this kind of fantasy land where, because we all believed these things, they had truth for a long time in a way that was lucrative for people. But we've got to get back as an economy to focusing on designing
real things,
real stuff, real things.
Now, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke says the recession is likely over, but that unemployment is going to lag. What's your view?
Well, as a technical matter, first of all, if Ben Bernanke says the recession is technically over, Ben Bernanke's a smart guy. A lot of credentialed economists do think that, but that's cold comfort. If you don't have a job, if your life savings have been hacked in half, and retirement that you thought was happening next year or, you know, soon thereafter isn't happening, if you can't pay your health care bills, if you're worried that now you could lose your job. I mean, ultimately, the tail's sort of wagging the dog here. I mean, if unemployment is 10+% and stays there for a long time, I don't think a lot of people are going to be, you know, whistling happily down the street that, you know, goody, the recession's over. I mean, we need some jobs.
Peter Goodman and his new book, it's titled Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. At 27 before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. And let's go first to Derek in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Good morning. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking the call.
Surely.
You know, I'm listening to this, and it just kind of makes my blood boil a little bit. I mean, the stories that you mentioned were not examples of people that were tricked or fooled or victims. They were they're examples of people who chose to do risky behavior. The behavior turned out not good, and they paid the consequences for it. There's a big difference between the individuals that you're talking about and what happened in the financial market. I mean, you know, the financial markets, sure, they maybe caused the economy to go down, but the woman you talked about who intentionally leveraged herself to the hilt so she could live in neighborhoods that she couldn't afford, that person doesn't deserve any kind of bailout.
Well, I hear what you're saying. First of all, leveraged herself to the hilt. I mean, she was never even in a position to leverage herself to the hilt like somebody of real means. I mean, she was somebody who was living essentially paycheck to paycheck and did have some credit card debt. And for, you know, 18 years, managed to keep it together such that she has two girls who, you know, one's in college and the other got a master's and is now teaching. I mean, she's dealing with two competing societal imperatives. One is get your kid to college. If your kid doesn't get to college, you're going to perpetuate poverty. In fact, Dorothy says, I didn't get out of poverty, but I got my two girls out of poverty. I was the bridge. And I'd suggest that if you were in that situation, you might find that choice. There might be powerful appeal there to do what you need to do to get your kid to college. Now, I'm not suggesting that she bears no responsibility, nor would Dorothy suggest that she bears no responsibility. But what do we do now as a society? I mean, the ramifications of the decisions that were made on Wall Street and our economic policies have put us in a position where you may have lived with pristine credit or you may have been incredibly reckless. And either way, you're living in a country that is pushing 10% unemployment. That's a problem.
What about somebody like Greg Bailey of Oakland, California? You say he missed out on the benefits of easy money, but somehow got hit disproportionately by the downturn.
Yeah, that's right. Greg Bailey is a guy who was born in a middle-class household in Oakland. His mom was a telecom customer service representative for the local phone company. She was making $70,000 in 1985. He was a high school basketball star at Bishop O'Dowd High School in Oakland, was about to go off to college with an athletic scholarship. His mother, unfortunately, got swept up in the crack cocaine epidemic, which hit Oakland and many cities in the U.S. very, very hard in those years. And Greg felt like he had to stay home and take care of his younger brother, keep an eye on the house, try to care for his mom. He didn't go to college. He ended up working in a tile store in Berkeley. He ended up doing a bunch of relatively low-wage, physically demanding jobs, and all along the way said, you know, I'm going to get back to it. He tried to go to college a couple of times. He just couldn't handle, you know, being the breadwinner, taking care of his mom, and going to school. And after more than a decade of installing refrigerators, driving trucks, delivering seafood for a seafood distributor, at one point actually driving fiber optics cables around the Bay Area back during the dot-com boom, he said, I really got to do something about this. And he went to this job center where I had met Dorothy Thomas as well, and got himself into a biotech training program. I mean, the state said, this is the future. Get a little education. He got an associate degree. He was there for 17 weeks. And then he just simply could not get a job. He was looking and sending out his resume. And when I met him, he'd been out of school for 6 months. He was really starting to get very depressed. And now he was looking for the sorts of jobs he'd tried to get away from before and couldn't even get those jobs.
Peter Goodman of the New York Times. His new book is titled Past Due. We'll take more of your calls when we come back, and your email as well.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the Pew Charitable Trusts, whose financial reform project provides analysis to guide the debate over financial modernization, at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ted Danson about his roles in the new HBO series Bored to Death, the FX series Damages, and Larry David's series Curb Your Enthusiasm, in which Danson plays himself. And of course, we'll talk about the role that made him famous, Sam Malone on Cheers. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And if you've just joined us, the book we're talking about, all about the end of easy money and the renewal of the American economy, is by Peter Goodman. He's a reporter on economics with the New York Times. The book is titled Past Due. Here's an email from Peggy in St. Louis, Missouri. She says, quite a while ago, interest paid on credit card debt was a tax deduction. That changed, and only interest on home equity loans was deductible. After that, people took out home equity loans for a variety of purchases not related to the value of their homes. Did this shift contribute to the later problems?
Yeah, no question that decision to make interest on all mortgages tax deductible contributed to the bubble. I mean, it created enormous demand for housing that wouldn't have been there otherwise. Moreover, people started to finance cars and, of course, home equity lines of credit, which could get poured into anything from flat screen televisions to honeymoons and other vacations. And it gave the mortgage industry another tool to use to convince people in some cases to do things that otherwise wouldn't have made a lot of sense.
Here's an email from Tom in Virginia who says, for 30 years, I worked as a carpenter for people who lived in houses they could not afford, who bought cars they could not afford. What has always been most galling is that I'd say 75% of my clientele, though nice people, have always placed far too much value on their possessions than on the humans who provide their services. If I ruled the world, he says, Tim Geithner would make $5 an hour. Nurses would make $100 an hour. It's not just capitalism, democracy, and Christianity. It's our whole system of human valuation that needs reform.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I mean, I think one can argue, I try to make this argument in the book, that in essence, we've perverted a lot of our traditional values that have actually served us quite well. I mean, the Protestant work ethic is buried in our society pretty deep. The thesis that, you know, it's good to go out and make money and be industrious and look after our material gain. And by doing that, it gives us a reason to get up in the morning and gain new skills. Hard work is a good thing. The problem is that there has been a perversion of that such that Wall Street, Madison Avenue, our own desires have all come together to turn materialism into a strain that's so powerful that it's sort of overridden the moderation that used to be in our society.
All right, let's take a caller in Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Stephen. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for taking my call, and
sure.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So, I was calling on the point of the bankruptcy reform that occurred, legislation that was certainly funded or championed by the credit card industry, who are ultimately at least partly responsible for allowing people to have the options to get so over-leveraged and overextended. And so I would like the guest to comment on how the bankruptcy reform under the Republican Congress changed people's ability to rectify their personal situation when they do get to the point where, you know, they've gone too far. And
in other words, you're saying making bankruptcy too easy a thing to choose.
Well, no, I'm saying that the bankruptcy reform that occurred in the previous administration certainly was tilted toward the interests of creditors. Instead of it took away the benefits of people who were trying to reconcile their debt.
Yeah, but just think about the number of bankruptcies that we've seen on the parts of individuals over the last 20 years. In bankruptcy used to be something that very, very few people went toward. There was shame involved. No longer.
Well, I think you make an interesting point in terms of shame. The whole banking industry has gotten really impersonal, right? I mean, you used to go to the local bank and you'd get a mortgage or get a credit card.
And you knew
there was some
your
relationship.
Banker, yeah.
Right. I mean, now we know that the loans are getting sold around the world. We know that, you know, Washington Mutual Bank virtually collapsed and cost its shareholders a ton of money, cost homeowners a ton of money by encouraging them to take mortgages that were ridiculous, whereas the executives kept their money. The same can be said of Countrywide, which is now part of Bank of America. I mean, shame. I mean, let's remember, President Bush pressed something called the ownership society, where we were supposed to own homes and take control of Social Security, and we were going to be in control of our own assets, and there was going to be a kind of accountability that went along with that. Well, combined with a kind of abdication of regulatory authority, where there was very little attention paid to predatory lending, to mortgage brokers getting paid obscene commissions to steer people into loans that didn't make any sense for them. The public's kind of woken up now, and they've said, well, where's the shame? I mean, shame over what? Who's the institution that I'm stiffing if I can't pay? It's not some guy down on the corner whose kids play with my kids.
It's this institution, and who cares?
Well, you know, that's right. And one of the reasons we got into this real estate bubble is because the mortgage industry ran out of creditworthy people to lend to. So they started turning people who weren't really creditworthy into, you know, fake creditworthy people. Well, now the public wouldn't be wrong to say, with all these people bankrupt, who's the financial system supposed to lend to? I mean, if I go bankrupt, if I don't pay, eventually they're going to need me just as much as I need them. Now, I'm not validating that. I'm not suggesting that that's a good financial plan. I'm just saying that's out there in our culture now. There is a kind of erosion of shame. There is a disconnect now between our financial system and ordinary people who've used it.
Let's take a caller in Laurel, Maryland. Good morning, Fred.
Good morning, Diane. Welcome back, and I hope you have fully recovered.
Not quite, but I'm on the road. Thank you.
Okay. Diane, your topic touches me a lot because I am highly qualified in terms of teaching, which is my profession, and I worked for the DC public schools, but what happened was I didn't have a DC teacher's license and was terminated just at the point where I was getting my license. I got my license, I applied, and I did not get back in, and I've tried to, this was last September, and I tried to send out my resume to different school districts, but everywhere they say no new appointments because of the economy, and that a freeze on new appointments is all over the place. And now I am at the point of losing my home. My house will be foreclosed next Tuesday.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
You know, I just depend on my unemployment benefits, which won't last much longer. The only hope I have now is that I've just published a book that I'm trying to sell. Maybe that will sustain me. But the situation is really dire, and for no reason. I have two master's degrees, one a Master of Science from London School of Economics and a Master of Arts from George Washington University.
And Fred, what is your teaching field?
It's in special education.
I see. You know, we've heard so much about the D.C. public schools now laying off teachers that they hired just last summer because of a shortfall in money. It would seem that this is going on all over the country.
Yeah, it's a real crisis, and there's more of it to come in terms of state and local governments. Sales taxes are down. Virtually every kind of tax revenue is down, given that the economy has really been just in a horrible place for the last 18 months. And that does mean some very painful cuts around the country.
And what do you say to someone like Fred?
Well, first I say it's an awful story, and
I'm,
you know,
so
my heart
sorry.
Goes out to him. Unfortunately, it's a very common story. I talk to people in this sort of situation all the time. The foreclosure crisis is horrendous. It's still with us. There are many, many people today fighting to save their homes, trying to modify their loans with mortgage companies, trying to come up with the cash seeing if they can take a deal for forbearance and hope that the future looks better than the present. It's very hard to come up with, you know, a pat bit of advice.
That's right.
It's a tough market out there.
Good luck to you, Fred, and I hope your book does well. Let's go to John in St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I just want to say I'm very glad to hear Mr. Goodman talking about the role of kind of the deregulatory mania that played in this whole meltdown. But I'm wondering if he has some of the same reactions that I have when I hear some of the kind of free market zealots kind of responding now. I mean, what I hear a lot of is a lot of hand-wringing about how the regulators went wrong, for example, with how the SEC failed to find, you know, Madoff. And to me, the answer is, well, the first thing is you have to appoint people to positions like the head of the SEC who are serious about regulating. You know, all the instructions and the pressure, and I work in a regulated industry, so I saw it in my field, you know, all the pressure on these so-called independent agencies was to conform to this kind of deregulatory mindset. So I don't see why anybody should be surprised about the fact that they did not, in fact, regulate. In fact, now some of them are claiming that this is reason why we ought to do things like abolish the SEC. So, I mean, I think the real answer is we need to identify problems. We need to regulate in a common sense way that tries to get at those problems. And hopefully we're going to get back to a more rational discussion about the role of regulation in the financial markets.
Well, I hear you. This is deep in our culture, this kind of anti-regulatory bent. This goes all the way back to George Washington, who said in his farewell address, I mean, at that point, as an economist I talked to a couple days ago, said, you know, the word capitalism hadn't even been invented yet, but freedom had. And Washington said, business ought to be free, regulate with a light hand. This is very deep. Now, it got perverted. I mean, back to this point of our values being taken to great extremes over the last quarter century, where we were saturated in this idea that, you know, this is the land of Horatio Alger. Anybody can make it in America, and therefore we can entrust our fate to the market. And we'll see if we're scared enough now from what we've just been through to put some rules in place.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now, President Obama spoke the other day to Wall Street, and he's talked about new regulations. What do you believe needs to be in place in order to get this economy back on sound footing?
Well, for openers, I mean, in terms of regulations, we need to make sure that someone's paying attention to how many real dollars have been set aside in reserve against all of the dollars that have been bet. I mean, when a bank makes a loan,
yeah,
or created, synthesized through derivatives, when a bank lends some money, how many dollars have they set aside in reserve against the possibility that that loan will go bad? Because leverage got completely out of hand, and that's how what would have been a, you know, potentially nasty recession at the end of the real estate bubble turned into a catastrophe. And it's a good thing that we seem to have gotten over the worst of the financial crisis. But longer term, we need some high-quality jobs in this country. We need essentially to transition from tapping our homes through home equity lines of credit and our credit cards in place of income by building up our income. People need to bring home paychecks that allow them to pay the costs of middle-class life.
That means working longer for a lot of people who perhaps had thought they could retire or would retire.
It probably does mean that. It also means we need a strategy as a society to create a lot more high-quality jobs than we've got.
What does that mean? How do you create high-quality jobs?
Let me tell you about Newton, Iowa, which is the home of Maytag, the washing machine company. They lost close to 2,000 jobs in a town of 16,000 people when Maytag essentially shut down their operations and shifted the jobs elsewhere a couple of years ago. And in the space of a few months, people in Newton, Iowa managed to bring back 700 pretty high quality jobs and potentially more on the way by attracting companies that are building wind turbines and the piece parts of wind power. Iowa essentially woke up and said, well, what do we do well? We have a lot of people who know how to make stuff. We've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs. And we're sitting here next to what experts consider to be the Saudi Arabia of wind. They're on the Great Plains. This transition seems to be underway. The government's going to spend money helping us with this transition. A lot of states are now forcing utilities to buy a growing share of their energy from renewable sources. And they've done a very good job bringing in these wind power companies. Toledo, Ohio, to give you one other example, has been savaged by the difficulties in the auto industry. It's a glass town. This goes back more than 100 years.
Entire
manufacturers. A lot of these factories are now retooling to make solar panels. Now, I'm not suggesting that solar and wind power, you know, that's the answer to all of our problems. But this innovation is the answer to our problems. We have to get the incentives in place so that money's flowing to research institutions that are dreaming up ideas that can be turned into businesses. And we got to think about what do we do well and do that.
And you've got to think about where the money from the lobbyists is coming from. And that's part of the upside down of the current system. If we don't take care of all of that at the same time, we're going to find ourselves right back where we are now. Peter Goodman, thank you so much for being here. Peter Goodman is economics reporter for The New York Times. His new book is titled Past Due, The End of Easy Money and the Renewal of the American Economy. Let's hope that that last part is right on. Thanks for being here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.